From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I believe that we're going to do well tomorrow, and I believe that that's going to be a very significant message to the country.
We know that this has been an extraordinary election and continues to be, and we're working as hard as we can to try to do well.
Voters head to the polls today in Texas, Ohio, Rhode Island, and Vermont in a crucial test that could decide the fate of the Democratic presidential nomination. Then tensions are rising in South America after Colombian troops kill a leading FARC commander in a cross-border raid into Ecuador. Both Ecuador and Venezuela have shut down their embassies in Bogota and ordered troops to the Colombian border. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Voters are heading to the polls today in Texas, Ohio, Rhode Island, and Vermont in a day that's been described as Super Tuesday 2. Many political analysts say Hillary Clinton needs to win in either Texas or Ohio to stay in the race. During a campaign rally on Monday in Toledo, Ohio, Clinton suggested the race has a long way to go.
And I believe that we're going to do well tomorrow. And I believe that that's going to be a very significant message to the country. And then we move on to Pennsylvania and the states still ahead. So I'm just getting warmed up.
Senator Barack Obama's campaign stops on Monday included San Antonio, Texas.
President Clinton has been working hard on her behalf. And so, you know, we know that this has been an extraordinary election and continues to be. And we're working as hard as we can to try to do well. But this notion that there are particular kinds of states that you have to win just doesn't make too much sense.
In the Republican race, Arizona Senator John McCain could secure enough delegates tonight to win his party's nomination. In other campaign news, the Associated Press has obtained a memo confirming one of Senator Obama's senior economic advisors met on February 8th with Canadian consulate officials to discuss Obama's criticism of NAFTA. The memo said Obama's public critique of the trade deal should be seen as, quote, as more about political positioning than a clear articulation of policy plans. Obama's economic advisor, Austin Goolsbee, says his comments about NAFTA were misconstrued by the Canadian officials. Meanwhile, the criminal trial of one of Obama's former friends and fundraisers has begun in Chicago. In 2006, Antoine Rezko was indicted on charges of business fraud and influence peddling. Rezko has raised as much as $200,000 for Obama since 1996 and helped Obama purchase his home. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has arrived in the Middle East one day after Israel pulled its ground forces from Gaza. Rice blamed Hamas for trying to stop the peace process by firing rockets into Israel. Since last week, Israeli troops have killed at least 118 Palestinians. During the same period, Palestinian rocket fire killed one Israeli. Two Israeli soldiers also died in Gaza during the five-day offensive. The Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem has determined more than half the Palestinians killed in the Gaza Strip in recent days were civilians. On Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert warned Israel would continue to attack Gaza.
One thing I promise you, the armed force and security forces operations will not stop unless and until we achieve the objective of significant reduction in the firing of Qassam and Grad rockets at the residents of Israel.
Meanwhile, a group of children in Gaza staged a protest Monday using their own bodies to illustrate the suffering of the Palestinians residing in Gaza. The youth staged a mock funeral. Some children laid on the ground, emulating dead bodies, while others stood with chains around their hands. The Washington Post reports House and Senate Democratic leaders are preparing to cave in to threats by President Bush and grant some form of immunity to the telecommunications companies that help the government spy on Americans. The compromise bill would also expand government authority to eavesdrop on the international telephone calls and email messages of U.S. citizens without warrants. In other news from Washington, President Bush is expected to soon veto a bill that would have required the CIA and all intelligence services to abide by the same interrogation standards as outlined in the U.S. Army Field Manual. The Army Manual specifically bans waterboarding, mock executions, the use of electric shocks, beatings, forcing prisoners to perform sexual acts, and depriving prisoners of necessary food, water, or medical care. President Bush says the Army rules are too restrictive. In Somalia, hundreds of women and children marched through the town of Dolble today, one day after the U.S. attacked the town. On Monday, a U.S. Navy submarine fired at least three Tomahawk cruise missiles into southern Somalia near the Kenyan border. Al Jazeera reports four civilians died in the attack. The U.S. said the target was a, quote, known al-Qaeda terrorist. This marks at least the fourth U.S. attack on Somalia since U.S.-backed Ethiopian troops invaded the country in December of 2006. The U.N. Security Council has approved a third set of sanctions against Iran for refusing to suspend nuclear activities. The resolution calls for more travel and financial restrictions on named Iranian individuals and companies. Iran's U.N. ambassador, Mohammad Kazai, dismissed the council's decision as illegal and illegitimate.
The international community is once again witnessing that the credibility of the Security Council, whose primary responsibility is to maintain international peace and security, is readily downgraded to a mere tool of the national foreign policy of just a few countries.
The U.S.'s U.N. Ambassador Zamel Khalilzad said the sanctions are needed in part because Iran has allegedly funded militant groups in Lebanon, the Palestinian territories, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
If Iran continues down its current path, it would likely fuel proliferation activities in the region, which in turn could cause the demise of the NPT regime itself.
The U.N. Security Council approved the sanctions while Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was wrapping up a historic visit to Iraq. On Monday, he repeatedly called on the United States to withdraw its troops from Iraq. In other news from Iraq, the Marines have begun investigating a video posted online showing a smiling Marine throwing a puppy off the top of a steep hillside in Iraq. In a statement, the Marines said, quote, the video is shocking and deplorable and is contrary to the high standards we expect of every Marine. In Russia, opposition activists took to the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg Monday to protest Sunday's presidential election victory by Vladimir Putin's hand-picked successor, Dmitry Medvedev. The former world chess champion and opposition leader, Garry Kasparov, protested in St. Petersburg.
We don't think that what happened yesterday was an election in the understanding of a normal democratic country. Today we are staging a protest against this kind of transition of power. We are saying down with this monarchy, this dynasty. We believe this is just the beginning of a long-lasting protest against the result which has come about not from the choice of the people, but of the say-so of the clans and the Kremlin.
In economic news, the price of oil reached a new high on Monday, topping $103 a barrel for the first time ever. Some analysts are now predicting the price of oil could jump to nearly $4 a gallon by this summer. On Monday, billionaire investor Warren Buffett said the U.S. economy is essentially in a recession.
I would say by any common sense definition, we are in a recession.
What?
Yeah, well, we haven't had two consecutive quarters of GDP growth, but I will tell you that on balance, most people's situation, certainly their net worth has been heading south now for a considerable period of time.
The jailed Florida professor, Sami Alarian, has begun a new hunger strike to protest what he calls continued government harassment. On Monday, the Justice Department called for him to testify before a third grand jury, only weeks before his scheduled release date. Alarian has been imprisoned for 5 years on charges he was a leader of Palestinian Islamic Jihad. 2 years ago, a Florida jury failed to return a single guilty verdict on any of the 17 charges brought against him. Despite the jury's findings, Alarian remained in jail. Last year, Alarian was sentenced to an additional 18 months in jail for refusing to testify before a Virginia grand jury. Sami Alarian could now potentially be sentenced to even more time in prison if he refuses to testify before this new grand jury. Attorney Jonathan Turley said, quote, "The mistreatment of Dr. Alarian remains an international symbol of how the Bush administration has discarded fundamental principles of fairness in a blind pursuit of retribution against this political activist." Meanwhile, another man acquitted in a high-profile terrorism case is facing deportation based on the same charges a jury dismissed 2 months ago. Liglinson Lamarin has been charged with six others in Miami for plotting terror attacks, but he was acquitted in December. Many legal experts criticized the government's prosecution because the case rested almost entirely on one suspect's conversation with an FBI informant posing as a representative of Al-Qaeda. The Bush administration is now asking an administrative judge to order Lamarin's deportation based on the same charges that the jury dismissed. The 33-year-old Lamarin moved to the U.S. from Haiti as a child. He's now a legal U.S. resident. And in Washington state, three unfinished multi-million-dollar homes burned down Monday in the Seattle suburb of Woodinville. A sign left at the scene of the fire indicated it was set by members of the Earth Liberation Front. All the homes were unoccupied. No one was injured in the blaze that caused an estimated $7 million in damage. The homes were marketed as being located on a street of dreams. Some environmentalists had opposed the new luxury development because of its close proximity to the Bear Creek, which is home to endangered Chinook salmon. The fire occurred while a 32-year-old violin teacher named Brianna Waters is on trial in Tacoma, Washington. Waters has been charged with acting as a lookout during a fire set at the University of Washington Center for Urban Horticulture in 2001. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. All eyes are on Texas and Ohio today, where voters head to the polls in two crucial nominating contests that could decide the fate of the Democratic presidential nomination.
I've got mixed emotions on the subject at the moment. Hillary and Obama, Democrat.
We've got support for Hillary Clinton. It's been a very positive for the households that we've called upon thus far. And we've got people that said they've already voted. And then the house that we just were at said that they intend to vote over to Rec Center on behalf of Hillary Clinton. So we're very confident that she will carry and do very well in the state of Ohio.
I've been here 8 years, and I think this is the first presidential race that Ohio has been really involved in.
Obama, 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 Obama. I don't know. It's absolutely like a new hope, and it's a new generation. I feel like I finally have something to vote for instead of a lesser of two evils.
You know, I haven't really decided. I'm still tossing it around, to tell you the truth. I watched the debate, and I'm still tossing things around. I really don't know.
How are you doing?
Hi,
how are you?
Okay.
Great. I'm Deanna. I'm with the Barack Obama campaign.
Oh, well, I'm so sorry you made this stop. I'm a Hillary fan.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Polls show Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in close races in both Ohio and Texas. Obama has said Clinton may have to quit if he wins in both states, but she has vowed to stay in the race. Rhode Island and Vermont vote on Tuesday as well. A total of 370 delegates are at stake in the four races, which include 64 delegates up for grabs in Texas caucuses, which are separate from the state's primary and begin after the day-long primary vote. Obama has spent twice as much as Clinton on TV ads in Texas, including ones in Spanish. Hispanics account for about 1 in 5 eligible voters in Texas. A loss by Clinton in either Texas or Ohio could set off a stampede of party support for Obama, increase pressure on Clinton to drop out, and make it even tougher for her to catch up to his lead and pledge delegates. According to the Associated Press, Obama currently has 1,385 delegates to Clinton's 1,276, a total of 2,025 is needed to secure the Democratic Party's nomination at its national convention in August. Wayne Slater is the senior political writer with the Dallas Morning News, co-author of Rove Exposed, How Bush's Brain Fooled America. He joins us from Dallas, Texas. We're also joined on the telephone by David Rohde, a professor of political science at Duke University. David Rohde, let's begin with you just for the general shape of these four states and why Texas and Ohio are so significant.
Well, they're significant because they're really the last chance for Senator Clinton to make significant inroads in the delegate lead that Obama has. Because the Democrats award their delegates by proportional representation, to make any significant gains in delegates, she has to win by a substantial margin, and that's the real challenge for her.
And talk a little about Rhode Island and Vermont, not talked as much about, though folks are going to the polls in both of those smaller states as well.
Well, there are a lot fewer delegates at stake, but given the state of the race, every delegate's important now, especially to Clinton. So Rhode Island, for example, is a state in which she's had maintained a substantial lead even after the lead in Texas and Ohio has winnowed down. So it's a chance for her to make some gains.
Wayne Slater, you write for the Dallas Morning News, co-author of Rove Exposed. Talk about the unusual system in Texas. You have both a primary and a caucus for Democratic voters. How did that happen?
Basically, it was the product back in 1988 in the Democratic Party of a reform movement. The idea was that the party officials wanted to get Democrats more actively involved in the affairs of the party. So they thought if we hold a caucus on the evening of an election, a primary election, we could have real people show up, get involved in party affairs. But what's happened is that this primary process has become very complicated, very contentious. And so what you have are about a third of the delegates tonight are going to be decided by the popular vote across the state. And then people who have voted at one point, either early or today, go to their caucus tonight, maybe at a school or a firehouse or somewhere else, where they'll vote again and distribute another one-third of Texas delegates. We may not know how that full distribution goes for a day or two.
But explain how that whole system took place. I mean, it's one of the only places in the country. It's not for the Republicans, is that right? A caucus and a primary, only for the Democrats.
That's right. Again, it was a product of people wanting to bring Democrats into the party in an active involvement. So they said, we'll have these precinct conventions at night. Where the delegates, the people who voted, can show up with their neighbors in 8,000 places around Texas and vote again for the distribution of other delegates. Now, what's happened in the process is that the distribution of delegates, say, for the two-thirds, is based on how the party voted, how Democrats voted in the last two elections. Basically, if you voted a lot, if you're in a place like Houston or Dallas or Austin, had a good Democratic turnout in the last two elections, you got lots of delegates. Well, what's happened this year is that Barack Obama has done pretty well in places, expected to do pretty well in places that have a lot of delegates. Austin with young people, Houston and Dallas with large African-American populations. Hispanic Texans generally do not turn out in big numbers in general elections based on this formula. So you have the Hillary Clinton people who expect to do very well among Hispanics in South Texas, with fewer opportunities to pick up delegates. It's odd because a vote in Dallas, in effect, is worth more than a vote in South Texas. Again, it was a product of a reform effort to improve the party, but it's now become really a subject of criticism.
And it means that you vote twice?
It does. You basically, I'll go to the polls today in my polling place, and I'll vote. And then tonight, I'm actually not going to be one, but tonight I would then show up at that place or somewhere nearby at my precinct caucus, my precinct convention. I'll gather into a room, and there'll be, the whole goal is, and obviously the Clinton and Obama people are both trying to get people not only out to vote today, but get people into those rooms tonight. It'll kind of be a mini Iowa, where you'll sign in, and you'll you'll say, I'm for Clinton, I'm for Obama. There'll be an effort to encourage people to switch one side or the other. There'll be discussions. They could be lengthy discussions. It could be fairly short. And at the end of the process, at this process, there will be a leader who will say, okay, we voted for Clinton a certain percentage or for Obama. And that information is then forwarded to the state party, who will then use it in its complicated formula to distribute one-third of its pledged delegates at stake. It's real complicated, Amy.
Do you think it's going to change? It sounds like even a lot of people in Texas didn't know exactly how this worked.
I guarantee you, good, solid Democrats didn't know how this was going to work, because until this year, it hasn't mattered. The only people who were showing up for these caucuses were the kind of real activist neighborhood Democrats who would want to go and talk about what resolution they want to be presented to the state convention in the summer and that kind of thing. But this year, because Texas is in play, and remember, this is George Bush's state, and Texas, for the last generation, has really had little say in primary elections in terms of presidential side. Any significance, our election was so late, we were so relatively unimportant. But this year, because of the nature of things, it's extraordinarily close contest where Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are effectively tied in most polls here in the state. Every vote counts. Every delegate counts. So these arcane processes that nobody was paying attention to have critical importance.
Now, the Clinton campaign has been saying that the caucus results should not be released right away. Why is that? Explain how it works.
Yeah, their argument is that because it's so complicated, basically there's two sides to this now, because it's so complicated that if you actually begin to release partial caucus results, remember, after the polls close at 7 o'clock here, the caucus can begin, but there could be long lines, the polls may not close till 7:30 or 8, and it's only then that your caucus starts, the caucus could go on for hours, and if you have a partial release of these delegates that are distributed on the caucus, it might give a false sense of what's going on in the process. What's really going on, Amy, is that the Clinton people understand that the Barack Obama forces are really extraordinary and have been on the ground, and they're likely to do very well in this caucus. Hillary Clinton, I think the professor was exactly right, Hillary Clinton has to win Ohio and Texas today, or it's really difficult to see how her campaign can succeed because she's behind in the delegates. Her goal tonight is to win the popular vote in Texas, if she does, declare victory, and say, let's worry about that delegate distribution until later. She doesn't want a release of the caucus delegate distribution, which is likely to favor Obama, to muddy a message in the event that she wins the popular vote. She wants to say, I win, and let's move on.
So who determines this? Who's going to decide whether the caucus, preliminary caucus results are released immediately or held on to?
The Texas Democratic Party. And all signals I'm getting, and I've been on the phone with them every day, all signals I'm getting from the Texas Democratic Party is they're going to release every piece of information that they have as quickly as they get it. I think their intent, and I know that the party's intention is to be fair to everyone, and to when they get caucus information from these 8,000 caucuses, they're going to interpret it, because it has to be interpreted, what does it mean, and then release that information to the media. They've actually set up a room at party headquarters here in Austin to do that. The complicating factor is not their intent, which may be good, it's this thing is so complicated, it really is a function of what happens in these 8,000 sites. Do they actually gather the information? Will they actually get this information to the party? I could see hundreds and hundreds of these caucuses fighting until well into the evening so that the state party really doesn't know what's going on. My guess is we'll have some sense tonight, certainly a good sense about the popular vote, and I think we'll have the beginning of a sense of what's happening in the caucus vote tonight before it's all over.
And Wayne Slater, the major issues right now in Texas, what are they fighting over?
You know, there was a discussion earlier about NAFTA, I know, and that really is not a significant issue here as it is in Ohio. Healthcare is important, and taxes obviously are important on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, I think you're talking about fundamentally an effort to move beyond the Bush years. I think one of Barack Obama's most popular lines I heard the other day in San Antonio at a huge rally was, you know, George W. Bush is not on the ballot in Texas. Got a great response. And he said, you guys are going to take him back. And you heard people in the audience say, no, no, we don't want him. And Barack said, nope, that's what's going to happen. You're going to have to take him back. It really is a turning the page on the Bush years. And I really think that this issue that Hillary Clinton has raised about Barack Obama's experience, whether he is up to the job of being commander-in-chief, may be a significant moment for her here in Texas. She needs to freeze the field among swing voters who are largely women, a small group of women who could go and really like both of these candidates. And her commercial, who do you want in the White House at 3 o'clock in the morning when someone calls and there's an international crisis, that commercial I sense is playing very well among women who are reassessing. And again, like both of these candidates, but want to think, is Hillary Clinton the right person? Is Barack Obama up to the job? I don't know who's going to win, but I know that, the stewardship of this country after the Bush years and going into a new era is something that I think Texas voters are taking very seriously.
And the significance of the Hispanic vote, Wayne Slater?
Enormous, enormous. And basically, what we expect is that 35 or 40% of the vote here in Texas is going to be Hispanic, much of it from South Texas, some from Houston and Dallas. Hillary Clinton, if history is any indication, we saw that in California, where I saw her and covered her there, the indications are she's doing very well among this vote. She's got to get at least two-thirds of these Hispanic votes. That's her edge. Barack Obama is doing very well among African Americans, who will represent maybe 20, 25% of the vote. But Hispanics are a population that are key to her in the primary. Hispanics do vote in the primary in large part because they have local races, judge races, and other things in South Texas that are important. The Clinton name is very, very well thought of from years of attention in South Texas. Hillary Clinton has brought Henry Cisneros, who is a kind of mini-god here in Texas among many Democrats and certainly people in South Texas. So she must hold on to that. If Barack Obama can eat into more than a third of that Hispanic vote, especially young Latinos, then Hillary Clinton is in trouble.
Your paper, Wayne Slater, though you're in Austin, the Dallas Morning News, endorsed Mike Huckabee over John McCain, though he could clinch it tonight as the Republican nominee. McCain, that is. Why Huckabee?
I think that now remember, Amy, I'm a reporter. I'm not on the editorial side. I wasn't involved in making that decision. But I know what our paper said was, we know that Huckabee's not going to win. But Huckabee expressed, our paper is fairly conservative. It's fairly conservative economically and more moderate on social issues. And we know Huckabee is wrong on abortion, and we know Huckabee is wrong on gay marriage, on gay rights. But we feel that Huckabee expresses the kind of sunny side optimism that the conservative part of the Republican Party is missing. After 8 years of Karl Rove and George Bush and polarization and divide and conquer, then the Republican Party has to reassess and redefine itself if it's going to be successful. And the kind of conservative attitudes and the kind of conservative candidacy that Mike Huckabee has expressed is exactly the kind of thing that our paper says the Republicans have to do if they are to be successful against what is obviously an enormous wave for change and what looks like a Democratic year.
And being that you are the co-author of Bush's Brain and Rove Exposed, How Bush's Brain Fooled America, finally, Wayne Slater, how the Bush administration is thought of in Bush's home state of Texas?
Well, it's thought of better here, Amy, than it is in many other places. But, you know, once upon a time, George Bush had a 70% popularity, job approval rating here in Texas. It is now below 50%, maybe about 40%. That's higher than in many other states. I think there is a sense, and I talked to, and I've known these people for 20 years, people who worked with George Bush and his administration, there is a clear sense that this administration is a failed one, that George Bush, who was a really well-thought-of figure in Texas, is someone who may not have been up to the job in the presidency. I think there is some sense of embarrassment by some moderates in Texas. Sure, there are Republicans who will defend this administration pretty much along the lines that Rove and Bush have espoused, But I think there is a sense that he was a pretty good guy, who was able to pull people together in Texas, didn't do a bad job as governor, but has failed and has mismanaged the job of presidency.
Wayne Slater, I want to thank you for being with us, senior political writer with the Dallas Morning News, co-author of Rove Exposed, How Bush's Brain Fooled America. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we move from Austin, Texas, to Columbus, Ohio, the other big state of the four that have primaries and caucuses today. We'll go to Ohio. Stay with us. Preston Hart here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we go from Texas to Ohio, another state with primaries today, joined on the telephone from Columbus by Harvey Wasserman, independent journalist, co-author of Ohio Stolen Election, Voices of the Disenfranchised. Harvey Wasserman is senior editor at the Ohio-based freepress.org and editor of nukefree.org. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Harvey Wasserman. Where have you been spending your time over the last few days in this lead-up to today's vote?
Well, I was in Cleveland yesterday, and I'm in Columbus today, and I got to tell you, the weather is miserable. It's cold and rainy here in Columbus. It's cold and snowy up north. They actually moved election workers into hotels in some areas last night to make sure that they'd be available at the polls today. So I think all the conventional wisdom, all the polling is at the mercy now of the weather. And it's really hard to predict who will be affected, Obama or Clinton. We would know if today was election day, it would be a bad day for the Democrats, because bad weather always hurts the Democrats in Ohio. But it's unclear whether it's going to hurt or help either Obama or Clinton at this point.
I remember in 2004 those long lines at Kenyon College in the terrible weather, where people were standing in line for hours and hours waiting to vote.
Right. That was a setup. The Republicans did that on purpose. As you know from our many talks, the Kenyon College voters, some of them waited 11 hours because there were two voting machines there, and one of them mysteriously broke down at around 11 in the morning. But the kids stayed out. Many of them there were till 4 in the morning, although they were only allowed to vote because of a court order. Yesterday, now we have a new Secretary of State. We did have the infamous J. Kenneth Blackwell, who we, if we want to put it this way, credit for stealing the 2004 election for George Bush. Now we have Jennifer Bruner, a Democrat, who has really worked very hard to have a fair and open election here. She has opened the polls early. There were actually lines yesterday because people knew that the weather was very nice yesterday. Many, many people came out to vote and to bring in their absentee paper ballots. And there were lines just to deliver their paper ballots here in Franklin County because it was a beautiful day and they knew that the weather today was going to be miserable.
Harvey Wasserman, are you saying that ultimately on Election Day it hurts the Democrats more because the Democrats rely on just getting more people out?
Yes, that's been actually, there's always been a rule of thumb in Ohio. Bad weather, the Republicans win. Good weather, the Democrats win. And actually, it's held up pretty well. So the Democratic Party had better hope that Election Day come November is not like today. But we will have a very different situation in November because of the actions, frankly, of the election protection movement in this country and the victory of the Democrats in the 2006 election here, where we actually had a fair vote count for a change. The Democratic Secretary of State has been very open and aggressively committed to switching the state to paper ballots. And she will also keep the polls open and do everything possible. Up until this year, to vote absentee, you had to provide a reason why you would not be in the county in order to obtain an absentee ballot. Now, there's no such requirement. You can just request an absentee ballot, as I did for this primary, and get one. You can get it in the mail. You can mail it back in. Really, under the Democrats, there have been tremendous strides in making vote counting and vote casting open and easy.
And the issue of Diebold, the maker of the electronic voting machines, being taken over, Harvey Wasserman, voting machines, a major issue for you.
You raised this last night. It's an interesting situation. United Technologies, which is a major defense contractor, has made a very large bid for Diebold, who made the voting machines on which much of the vote was stolen in 2004. As of this morning, Diebold has rejected the bid. Now, whether this is all bidding and, you know, maneuvering for money, we'll see. There's an interesting conflict going on, though. Voting machines, electronic voting machines, were brought into Cleveland, to Cuyahoga County, at the cost of $20 million over the extreme objections of many of the citizens and the election protection movement up there. And now Jennifer Bruner is, after just one election, is rejecting those machines and switching the county over to paper ballots. What Diebold's future may be as an election voting machine, electronic voting machine company, we don't know. I mean, we are hoping nationwide that electronic voting machines will be done away with entirely by November, but we don't know. There is, of course, as you well know, a very important the case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court that will affect the outcome, which is the question of voter ID, photo voter ID. It's an Indiana case. The state of Indiana has put forward a demand for voter ID with a photograph. The opposition, I think, correctly says this is a poll tax. This court case has been heard in front of the Supreme Court. The reports were that certainly the four Republican justices will uphold this, and it could have a big impact, because if photo voter ID is required in many states, it very strongly favors the Republicans, because a lot of older people, younger people, poor people don't have photo ID, and they could be disenfranchised. This is something very important that people need to watch around the country.
Interesting also that Charlie Black, who is a lobbyist for United Technologies, is also top campaign advisor for campaign manager for John McCain.
Yes. There will be blood, as they say. They're going to be trying to they will do everything they can to disenfranchise people coming November. It's going to be a little more difficult. I think that we can be very proud in this country, and your show has certainly helped, of the building of an election protection movement that has made a difference. I don't think that the Democrats would control Congress right now, much as it's been worth anything, to had it not been for an election protection movement that really prevented a rerun of what happened in 2004 and 2002 in this country, with the Karl Rove Republicans stealing many elections and many votes. But it's not going to be a perfect situation, and this photo voter ID is extremely important. I will mention to you, in Ohio, we have you're allowed to present one of 17 different types of identification, many of which do not require a photo. So, you know, it is possible to have ID required, which does not constitute a poll tax. And the Ohio situation is actually certainly fairer than the Indiana requirement for a photo ID.
Charlie Black, and a top advisor to John McCain. Last question. The issue of NAFTA, major issue in Ohio. This news, this controversy that is swirling about with the AP obtaining a memo confirming that one of Senator Obama's senior economic advisors met with the Canadian consulate officials to basically tell them this is overheated campaign rhetoric, what Obama is saying, that they shouldn't worry about NAFTA being renegotiated. I'm definitely paraphrasing all of that. How is that playing?
It's hard to tell at this point. And again, any any final outcome is really going to be caught by the weather in terms of that. The polls have, this was a last minute kind of issue that came up here. NAFTA is a huge issue in Ohio, and it has been really a bad one for the Clintons because it was put through under Bill Clinton, and it's had a devastating impact on the Ohio economy, which is really hurting and doesn't show much sign of improving at this point in time. So the fact that the NAFTA was raised at the end here by the Clinton campaign, I think, is an indicator of how seriously they take the issue and how importantly it will play in the coming general election. I will say also that who do you want to call at 3 a.m. Was kind of, I'm not sure how that's playing among Democrats, but it certainly would play to John McCain's favor in the general election. And it's important to understand a lot of these swipes that are being taken between the candidates will have an impact as the campaign goes on once the nominee for the Democrats is decided. We also have, as we mentioned, there's an important race in Cleveland. Dennis Kucinich, Congressman Dennis Kucinich, the stalwart of the attempt to impeach, the long overdue impeachment of George W. Bush, is being challenged. I was in Cleveland and saw some of the ads that have been run against him by his fellow Democrats. They are really brutal. He's expected to pull through, but that is an extremely important race today that people should keep their eyes on.
Running again for his own seat as a congressman, though he was a presidential candidate.
Seventh term. And, Dennis Kucinich saved the municipal light system in Cleveland. He's a real hero up there, which is really playing out now because electric rates are so high among the private utilities, and the public muni utility customers' rates are much lower, and it's a much greener utility. Dennis Kucinich is a real hero in Cleveland, and I don't think they're going to beat him, but an attempt has certainly been made, and people need to be aware of that.
Harvey Wasserman, I want to thank you for being with us, senior editor at the Ohio-based FreePress.org, co-author of Ohio's Stolen Election, Voices of the Disenfranchised.
It's a great show, as always.
Thanks, Harvey. We turn now very quickly to Vermont, to journalist David Goodman, also happens to be my brother, where they are voting today as they head off all over the state right now to their town meetings. Hi, David.
Hi, Amy.
What's happening in Vermont?
Well, today is town meeting, which is all state business and schools are closed. It's the annual exercise in direct democracy where we go, and I will, as soon as I get off the phone, be going to discuss in my community the issues and debate the issues of the day, which also sometimes touch on national and international issues. Last year, Vermont, at town meeting, a number of communities debated and passed impeachment resolutions, and this was really captivated many people in the state. This year, there is, in Brattleboro, a resolution to calling for the indictment of Bush and Cheney, which mirrors resolutions in Kennebunkport, Maine, and Portland, Oregon, which is really a symbolic resolution. It would technically authorize the local police to arrest them if they came there, but really it's meant to boost efforts, more serious efforts in Europe in particular, to bring charges, war crimes charges against Bush and Cheney. But it's just an indication of how town meeting really covers a gamut. As for the current election here, it is a sign of how close this race is with Clinton and Obama in particular that Vermont has come into play. The Vermont primary, which is always on town meeting day, there are 20 delegates at state at stake here. Over you need roughly 2,000, a little over 2,000 delegates nationwide to win. So with just 1% at stake here, but they're saying that the 1% could in fact decide the whether it goes to Clinton or Obama. So polls here, statewide polls, show Obama leading by roughly 20%. State political leadership has been divided in their support. Senator Leahy and Congressman Peter Welch, Pat Leahy, of course, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, have been backing Obama. Leahy, in particular, in the last few days, has been speaking very forcefully, tying Clinton to the war, and saying that as a result, she does not deserve to be president. Others who've lined up behind Clinton include the Speaker of the House, Gay Symington, and former Governor Madeleine Cunin.
And Senator Sanders, the independent, has not taken a position.
Bernie Sanders has said he will not campaign for anyone until after the race is basically decided. He is, as you say, an independent and wants to maintain that status in this race.
So do you all vote in your town meetings?
We do. We go in throughout the course of the day. The polls are open, and so debates are taking place on the floor. It'll be in my local elementary school, and in the back of the room, people are voting on everything from their school budgets right up to who they are voting for to nominate to be president. The bigger news around here is that Hillary Clinton discovered Vermont last week. She had little or no presence here politically. Obama had had a campaign office for quite some time now, had seven offices throughout the state. Clinton did not gear up for Vermont until about 2 weeks ago. The highest profile surrogate appearance was by her daughter, Chelsea Clinton, who showed up in Burlington last week. So Clinton is playing catch up here in terms of organizing.
Well, we're going to leave it there. We'll find out how the state goes tomorrow as we will, of course, cover what happens after what is known as Super Tuesday 2. David Goodman joining us from Waterbury, Vermont. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go international to look at what's happening with Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela. Why are Ecuadorian and Venezuelan troops lining up on the border with Colombia? Stay with us. Sonora Matanza, Mano Negra, the artist, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Tensions are high in the Andes following Colombian military attack in neighboring Ecuador. A leading commander of the FARC and 20 other fighters were killed Saturday when Colombian troops crossed the Ecuadorian border in a pre-dawn raid. Colombia called the attack a major blow to the FARC rebels. The commander, Raul Reyes, had been viewed as a possible successor to FARC's 77-year-old leader, Manuel Manulanda. On Monday, both Ecuador and Venezuela rushed troops to their borders with Colombia and said they would cut their diplomatic ties with Bogota. Venezuelan Foreign Minister Nicolas Maduro announced the expulsion of Colombia's ambassador in Caracas.
In the number of measures we have taken to safeguard national sovereignty, the respect and dignity of our institutions, of our democracy, the Venezuelan government has decided to expel the Colombian ambassador in Caracas and all of the diplomatic personnel in the Colombian embassy in Caracas.
Colombia said it found evidence in the FARC camp that Venezuela had given the rebels more than $300 million. Colombia also accused Ecuador of supporting the rebels. Both Venezuela and Ecuador denounced the charges and accused the Colombian president of lying. This is Ecuadorian Defense Minister Wellington Sandoval.
It's a completely harebrained idea. We do not have, nor have we ever had, nor will we ever have any ties with FARC. I must also say that in view that we have lost all contact and communication with the Colombian armed forces, I have asked the foreign ministry to end the agreement with COMEFORM.
For more, we turn to Mario Murillo, a longtime journalist, author of Colombia and the United States, War, Terrorism, and Destabilization, co-host of Wake Up Call on Pacifica radio station WBAI, and a professor at Hofstra University, where he is joining us from right now. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Mario, tell us about the significance of the killing of Raul Reyes, a man that you interviewed several times.
Well, it's great to be with you, Amy. It's a very significant development on many fronts. First of all, of course, this is the first time in over 44 years of counterinsurgency warfare that the Colombian government and the armed forces actually knocked down one of the top commanders of the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. Raul Reyes, as you rightly put forward in your introduction, was the second in command, basically. He was considered the official ambassador, diplomat of the FARC, who traveled all around the world, to El Salvador, to Latin America, to Europe, talking with all different kinds of leaders. And he was perhaps the most visible of all the FARC commanders, especially after the 1999 peace talks that began with President Andrés Pastrana. So he was one of the most visible leaders. He was also, ironically, the person who most likely could reach some kind of an accord, because he was much more of a diplomat than he was perhaps a military strategist. And in fact, some people in the FARC had in early days made fun of him, saying that he wasn't necessarily a strategist, he was more of a diplomat. Knocking him down, killing him the way he was killed, was a big public relations victory for Álvaro Uribe Vélez, the president of Colombia, especially in light of what has been going on over the last couple of weeks. It came as an opportune time, because there's been criticism of Uribe Vélez for not really carrying out serious measures to release the hostages that the FARC have been holding for some time now. Just last week, four hostages were released by the FARC to the Venezuelan government because of the intervention of Hugo Chavez and the Venezuelan government. And those people, when they got to Venezuela, those people who were in captivity for six years, immediately started criticizing and calling into question Uribe Vélez's positions, basically saying that, you know, we were walking through the jungles for 250 kilometers and we didn't see one soldier in sight. That one of them actually said that the FARC operate in the countryside, they move in the countryside in the jungles, much like fish in water. So there was a lot of criticism as to the security policy of Uribe, not to mention the political strategy of refusing to negotiate with the FARC to eventually release the hostages. Now that you knock out somebody like Raul Reyes, such a high visible figure in the FARC for so many years, it's almost as if it's a moot point, because it adds to the idea that Uribe Vélez has been arguing for so long, that we can win this fight militarily and we're not going to sit down and negotiate with these quote-unquote terrorists.
Mario, we're going to play just a clip of an interview that you did with Raul Reyes in 1996. Can you just set the stage for us? Where were you? Where did you video him?
Well, it was kind of a strange period. He was already a big figure in the FARC at that point when we interviewed him at this time in 1996 during the Sao Paulo Forum, which was a major forum for progressive and left movements throughout the hemisphere. It was before the World Social Forum that took place several years later. At this time, he was trying, of course, to do what he always did, which was build relations with progressive movements, with the FMLN, for example, in El Salvador, with other sectors who were struggling for social change on an international level. But he had not reached the kind of mythic proportions that he did in 1999, once he became perhaps the most visible spokesperson for the FARC during the peace negotiations. At this time, he was still kind of under the radar screen. And when we interviewed him, he deliberately asked us to get him by on profile as opposed to front forward, and it was an interesting discussion talking about some of the issues that were prevalent 12 years ago that in many respects haven't really gone away in Colombia today.
This is just a short clip of the now slain FARC commander Raul Reyes in 1996.
For peace, there has to be a policy that comes from the state. That means there has to be guarantees for the insurgency to sit with the government and to discuss about the new Colombia we should all construct. Right now, there are no guarantees. Right now, continued threats against the leaders of the guerrilla movements, the proliferation of murderers and massacres continues.
That is, well, the now slain FARC commander, Raul Reyes. I wanted to ask you, Mario, a high-placed official in the Colombian Defense Ministry said on condition of anonymity it was the U.S. intelligence agency that first told Bogota several weeks ago that Reyes was sporadically using a satellite phone whose signal could be pinpointed.
There's no doubt. I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, we still got to wait a little bit before we get more details as to the way this operation unfolded, a cross-border operation. We should continue reminding people that it was a cross-border incursion by the Colombian government. But it's eerily reminiscent of what happened in 1993 when the Colombian forces, with United States intelligence assistance and direct cooperation, killed the leader of the Medellin cartel at the time, Pablo Escobar, who was a fugitive from justice at the time. And what we see right now in 2008 is a process where the U.S. military assistance, 8 years of Plan Colombia, 6 years of Uribe's total war carried out against the FARC, and a real stepped-up improvement in the communications technology that the Colombian armed forces are using, resulting in this kind of attack, leading to the death of Raul Reyes. It would be hard to imagine that this kind of cross-border incursion could have occurred without the knowledge, without the understanding of the United States, especially given the large presence that the U.S. has, particularly in the southern part of the country. The military assistance that the United States has directed has been presented as a counter-narcotics aid package, $5 billion over the last 8 years in Plan Colombia. But there's no doubt that it has been really geared towards attacking the guerrillas. It's been a counterinsurgency aid assistance package that continues to maintain the same levels that it did even in 1999 and 2000 when Plan Colombia first started.
Mario, I wanted to go to Helga Serrano. She's an Ecuadorian activist with the International Network for the Abolition of Foreign Military Bases called No Bases. What is the response in Ecuador to this cross-border raid by the Colombian troops that killed the FARC commander, Helga?
Thank you for the call. We are outraged in Ecuador. We cannot imagine that our country, that is a neighbor, and we have about 500,000 Colombians here, which our country has received in solidarity because they have been displaced because of the conflict of the war in Colombia, and that President Uribe pays us like this by bombing our country, by being a puppet to the Bush administration, by using military bases like the Tres Esquinas in Colombia to carry out the attack. And we are asking and demanding an investigation to see if the base in Manta was also used in this attack. We are outraged. We are having a big demonstration Thursday, March 6th at 6 in the afternoon. There are demonstrations already going on yesterday. There will be another one today. And many organizations are calling, are supporting President Correa's position. He's got a very firm position. And we are demanding, once again, the closure of these military bases, which we feel are the structure from which these kind of activities are carried out.
We're also joined by Arlene Tickner, who's a professor of international affairs at University of Los Andes in Bogota. The response inside Colombia, Professor Tickner.
Unfortunately, the response has been full support of President Uribe. The case is being presented as a justified incursion into Ecuadorian territory in pursuit of terrorist groups that haven't been persecuted by the Ecuadorian government. This is basically the position of the government, and as I say, both the media and opposition parties have also fully supported the decision of the government to present the case in this way.
Mario Murillo, we're going to go back to you and end with you. With the troops on the border now, Ecuador sending troops to the border with Colombia and Venezuela, what is the possibility of open conflict?
I think that's less a possibility. I hope I'm wrong in this assertion. I think the bigger problem is the consolidation of what's going on right now with Uribe. Uribe, as our previous speaker just said, is 83 percentage point popularity in terms of this action or support of this action. And it comes just a few days before this massive mobilization that's taking place on March 6th, this big mobilization to call to question the impunity and the double standard of quote-unquote human rights, democracy and justice in Colombia, a massive mobilization to call in question the relationship between the Colombian government and paramilitary forces in the country that has been responsible for the vast majority of the displacements, the vast majority of the human rights abuses that have gone on in Colombia for the last 20 years or so. Uribe now, with this action that has taken place, with the killing of Raul Reyes and the international kind of uproar that's occurred, it's made it as if this March 6 mobilization against the paramilitaries, against the Uribe administration, is going to be almost like having a homecoming parade on the first day of spring break at a university. Nobody's going to be paying attention because of the level of the propaganda success of this operation against Raul Reyes.
We have to leave it there, and I thank you all for being with us. Mario Murillo's book is called Colombia and the United States: War, Terrorism, and Destabilization. Helga Serrano joining us from Quito, Ecuador, and Professor Arlene Tickner joining us from Colombia, from Bogota. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire from Boca Deuce, Aaron Mata, Angela Kamichev, Chris Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.